Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. The number to call with your questions, phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. We're also joined this morning with Michael Caron. You're probably familiar with Michael. He's been with us a few times. He is a USU Extension Associate Professor. And to start out the show this morning, our top of the hour feature is talking about the Master Gardener Program, because this is the time of year that people get excited about learning all the things that they need to do. And so, Michael, you're here to tell us all about the program.
Well, I don't know if all about it, but
all
a lot about,
it. You mean you could go longer than 10 minutes on the program? Okay.
So the Master Gardener Program is a volunteer-based training program that has been around a long time, started in Washington, state of Washington. And it basically is something that a lot of counties across the nation, even in the world, use this model to train volunteers to help them extend their reach. So the land-grant universities like Utah State University to extend their reach into the private sector, if you will, helping people with their gardens and farms and things, with growing food primarily. And to help spread research-based information about the local area, gardening in the local area. So in Utah, we have our program that starts in January, usually for most programs, starting sometime in January and going sometime either through March or through May, depending on the type of schedule or structure that particular county is offering. So we have programs in a lot of the counties throughout the state. We have most of the registration is usually done through Eventbrite, but you'll just need to call. The best thing to do is just to call the county office and find out. If you can't find it on Eventbrite or any other page, just to call the office and find out what they're offering as far as Master Gardener programs.
I emailed Michelle, our crack producer, super producer out there, a Master Gardener page that USU has that has a link to all the county offices so that you can call them. I will say that a lot of the counties, you know, this is a service-based program, but we do allow people to take the classes if they don't have time to do the service in certain situations. Like Utah County, you can just take it. We hope that you do service, but it's not a requirement. Some counties like Salt Lake, it is a requirement, and so you need to talk to the particular county. Now, we are offering Master Gardener classes for the first time, and this is just on for me, but we're offering a Nephi Santa Quinn Master Gardener class that will rotate between the two cities for people that live in South Utah County and Juab County. So that's brand new. That will start in March. But the Master Gardener classes, I get comments all the time from people that have taken the classes just saying, you know, my yard looked like garbage. I was killing my fruit trees all the time. And all of a sudden, my yard looks good. We re-landscaped using correct principles. We're irrigating. We're using 50% less water. And, you know, if they choose to do the service with other Master Gardeners, they actually oftentimes make lifelong friends because of the group of Master Gardeners.
Well, it is not only do people think it's cool. I mean, it's you get some cred when you get that certificate that says you're a Master Gardener. But what exactly does that mean? What did they do? What have they accomplished? I don't think people really get how detailed you guys are. I mean, this is about soil. It's about water. It's about pruning. So many different elements go into these classes.
So the topics that are covered in the various classes vary to some extent because they are personalized or customized by the counties that offer them. And usually that's because they are trying to fill specific needs, especially for volunteerism, say with public gardens or different types of activities they've got going on. And so typically the class covers about 15 subjects, more or less. And when I used to teach full-time the undergraduate classes for Utah State University in plant science, basically the Master Gardener program is like an introduction to horticulture class. It's basically equivalent to what we would cover in a 3-credit introduction to horticulture class. So we cover really a little bit of everything, but probably more in detail on some stuff than we would in an introduction class, especially when we get into like growing fruits and vegetables at home. We get into more details on that because that's really kind of a core interest that a lot of people that take the class want to have.
We do a specific class on small fruits, so berries and similar, strawberries, raspberries, grapes, and then there's also a tree fruit. So almost a full third of the class is devoted to optimizing home food production if you want to grow it yourself so you know where it comes from. But then there's classes like turf grass management, learning how to keep your lawn green, use less water, use fewer pesticides, or sometimes none at all, depending on what you're doing. And so there's a lot of useful things in the class that, you know, even if you don't do the service, you can help your neighbors and things sometimes just because of what you've learned.
Yeah, talk about the classes. I know during the pandemic you offered these online. Are you still doing online? What kind of time needs to be committed to these classes?
Again, so it varies a lot depending on the county. What we're doing in Utah County, we've gone to, ever since COVID forced us 100% virtual, after COVID, we've stayed with the model of in-person and virtual. So we actually broadcast our classes out. We have live in class participants that come if they want the in-person experience, but we broadcast that out via Zoom to anybody who can't make it to the class or just wants to do it from home. And so we don't require actual in-person class attendance. We kind of keep a role of who is attending online, and we have somebody that helps monitor that during our classes. So we've kept kind of a dual model where we do both. A lot of the other counties I know have gone just strictly back to face to face, and some do a little bit of what we're doing as well. So it does vary a lot, but
if you want to take it online and you live in a rural county that doesn't offer the Master Gardener program, you can register for the Utah County class because we do broadcast over Zoom. But then we put the recordings up. We usually within 48 to 72 hours, so that if you missed the class or you want to review it, you can just watch the recording. And Mike has a private YouTube channel that he sends the link out every week that you can go and watch previous classes if you want to do that.
Yeah, so I actually just established the link for the, I established the YouTube channel before class, and then every week we just add the new video and recording to that playlist. And so one of the questions I get asked a lot about that is, well, how long will we have access to that? And really, it's indefinitely. I don't share that. It's not open to the public. That's just, that link is just for people that sign up for the class.
Okay. So what is the cost? And again, the time commitment, how long are the classes?
The cost may vary by county, but the Wasatch Front, it's $200 to take the class per individual. That will, and it varies by county a little bit, but that oftentimes includes a manual if you want one, a paper manual, or else we can get you a PDF or both in Utah County. And then that money goes back into horticulture programming. We're not making anything off of the money, but the $200 supports programs within the county that are helping oftentimes at-risk populations, or helping with horticulture research, you know, finding new fruit varieties or rootstocks, or putting in new gardens. And so it always, the money that is collected for the classes goes right back into the public.
Okay, we need to take a break, but I'm going to just loop in Bart really quickly because he wanted to make a comment about the program. Good morning, Bart.
Hey, I've been a master gardener since 1989.
Wow.
When Larry and Dwayne were teaching the class. And I can't say enough good things about the Master Gardener program. I met Jerry Goodspeed, and I think Jerry brought the program from Washington down here and got it started.
Yeah, that's very possible.
One of the nice things about the Master Gardener program is all the people you meet with like interests. And I still got friends, and even though I'm in my 90s, I still have people calling me that are in the Master Gardeners or heard about it or been there and done it. And it's a great way for gardeners to get together and exchange ideas and do a lot of things that you normally wouldn't do.
Well, and I agree with you. I think that's where a lot of the learning comes from, actually, is kind of trying different ideas and being with like-minded
people. Well, Larry
had
me down there in Utah County. I went down to Thanksgiving Point and taught some classes later on, and he used the Master Gardeners as instructors throughout the valley. So I got to teach a lot of classes, and every time you taught one, you learned something.
Right.
So it was a great experience. It's a great program.
All right.
Thank you.
Bart, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. And we have put more information up on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We need to take a break. Number to call with your questions. Phone lines are now open, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Michael Karen with you, and Dave Meekum in his heyday playing Christmas music this morning on the Greenhouse Show. Thanks for being with us. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Let's wrap up our discussion about the Master Gardener program at USU. You wanted to tell us, Michael, about the places that are offering and are not offering the program.
Yeah, so the list is actually a lot shorter of the counties in Utah that aren't offering a program. So Morgan County doesn't have one specifically, but that's they're incorporated into the Weber County or the Ogden area. Box Elder County is not having a program this year.
They're incorporated into Logan.
San Pete County does not have one, as well as Sevier County, Millard County, Beaver County, Paiute County, Wayne County, and Garfield County do not have programs specifically in their counties.
But people in those counties can still take part online?
They can. They can register for our program. I think that Salt Lake, Heber, and Cedar City offer virtual also. Then USU also does, it's not really the Master Gardener program, but they do have a very in-depth online course that's similar to the Master Gardener classes that Mike helped put together a few years ago that they can just register and take completely independently on their own time.
Yeah, it's 8 classes on that one. So it's not as full bodied as the Master Gardener classes, but it was built with the intent online to help meet the need for people wanting basic horticultural information but weren't able to get to a Master Gardener class because it's not offered.
Okay. And for people who wanted the specifics, Ton, you had Michelle put up what on the Facebook page?
The Master Gardener landing page for USU, and then it will give them more instructions, and then it has information on how to contact their own county. Okay. USU Extension works by counties. There's usually a county office in every county almost. And USU programming isn't coordinated from Logan. For what we do is coordinated at the county level.
Okay. Our next listener has been waiting for just a bit to ask this question. They want to know, what's the best way to plant African daisies, by seed or plant?
Well, we're both looking at each other like,
I've
only ever planted them from seed. I'm not even sure if you can do them from cuttings. I imagine you could, especially for some of the newer varieties that bloom longer, more tolerant over heat. And so that's just one thing that when I was working in the nursery industry, we didn't sell a lot of African daisies. We usually brought them in. And I think that they were actually grown both ways, depending on what the needs were. They're a little less expensive to start from seed, but if you're wanting a particular style of bloom or how long, you know, extending the blooming season, mm-hmm. you have to do those from cutting.
So, well, first of all, I assume that the question is referring to the osteospermum,
African
AKA
daisies,
yes. African daisy. It's hard because sometimes daisies is a really broad term and we don't know. But if you have a plant that's indoors, because they're not winter hardy here, so if you've got a plant that's growing as a house plant, you can start taking cuttings from that in February or March to get them ready to go outside when the growing season starts. Otherwise, seed is your only realistic option, just simply because they're super frost tender.
And you need to start those when?
Several weeks before the first frost. Yeah. I would need to look up the exact dates, but isn't it about a 12-week, at
least
12 weeks?
Yeah, so you're going to be taking cuttings or planting seeds at roughly the same time.
Okay. Tom wants to know, he says, they bring their lemon and lime trees into a heated greenhouse during the winter. They flower, but how would they pollinate them without bees?
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. You sing that. Then you have to get a Q-tip and you have to make buzzing noises too. No, if you rub a Q-tip into the flower and just go around and just knock the pollen around a little bit, that will get it done.
Yeah, small paintbrushes work really well for that too.
All right, we're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Number to call with your questions. Phone lines are open. 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, Michael Caron joining you this morning to answer your questions. You can call us at 801-575-8255. People are waking up now. You can also text us at 57500. Next question on the text line, when is the best time to prune raspberries?
Raspberries can be pruned either in late fall or early spring, and it just depends on what is more convenient. If you cut them down in late fall, you can sometimes reduce the population of raspberry cane borer, which it's not a huge pest, but it is present and it causes problems. I don't know that we need to get into cane borer right now, but and what you're doing also will dictate a little bit when you prune, because if it's super muddy, you know, you don't want to be doing it then. So you need to know if you have summer or everbearers. The summer bearers you prune maybe differently. You can prune them the same, but USU has some really good fact sheets on how to prune them and the techniques you would use depending on what your goals are with the raspberries. So, but anytime from mid-November, you could even go out and do it now and be just fine. Or you could go and do that in early to mid-March.
Okay. Sarah is on the line in Mona. Good morning, Sarah. What was your question?
Hi. I've been propagating experimenting. I have some vinca flowers. They're under some grow lights, and they're getting this little mite that has a web, and I've tried triple action on it for quite a few weeks, and it doesn't seem to be keeping that at bay. What can I try?
So spider mites are a common pest on both landscape and indoor plants, and the first way I go about attacking them is taking the plants over to the sink and giving them a shower real good, and that will wash a lot of them off. They don't like water. And then after that, then I do the same thing like I was talking about on the show earlier with aphids, is I spray them with an insecticidal soap. And then I just try and keep them managed that way. But again, you probably won't eradicate them. It's just going to be always watching for them to recur. Look for the webbing. The webbing usually starts after the populations have built up pretty high. And they build the webbing to be able to access new plant material faster. So look on the underside of the leaves before you see the webbing. You'll find little stippled marks, and you'll see their little bodies moving around on the bottom.
A good magnifying glass can help you identify them. But when you spray, if you're just spraying the tops of the leaves, that won't kill the mites because they're usually on the undersides. And so you have to get the entire leaf. I mean, are these vinca, are they like emotionally important somehow? Were they somehow from a relative, or do they have some? Okay, because I mean, it may be that you go to the nuclear option and just get rid of them, and make sure they're isolated from other house plants and get new soil and either wash your containers thoroughly with soap and water or just get new containers and start over in a mite-free environment. Because like Mike said, you can manage them and keep them at low numbers, but it's really difficult to eliminate them. And the chemicals that would are very expensive, and you don't want to be using those in your home anyway.
Okay. But, yeah, I have them next to like some geraniums and some roses that I'm propagating, and I want the roses to work. So if I need to get rid of the vincas,
all of those, especially the roses, are spider mite favorites. So they're going to be a problem.
You've just opened up like a golden corral,
yeah,
and you've got the steak buffet on one, the dessert buffet on the other, and then like the cookies on the other for those spider mites.
So spray thoroughly, spray the soil surface, and then just monitor that regularly. Catch them when they're just starting to repopulate.
Okay, I've got my work cut out for me.
And if you do, say, get rid of the vinca, whatever's left over may hop to the other ones or back and forth. And so it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole a little bit.
Yeah, so I would treat all of those things, especially the rose, at the same time.
Okay, should I keep the vincas around just to kind of keep the spider mites to the vincas and not spreading to the other
plants? I would get rid of them because they are maybe acting as a hot spot that could spread to the others. And you never know, they could have come off the other plants into the vinca.
Yeah. And the idea that you presented is actually an idea that is used commercially in production. They're called indicator plants, and where they're preferred by the pest, and then it's not until they overwhelm the indicator plant that they move on to say the desirable crop. But what they do with the indicator plant is they destroy them after they become infested. So that kind of fits into what Tom was saying, is just get rid of them or fight the battle with everything that you have there.
Okay. Collateral damage. We'll do that.
Yep.
All right, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your call this morning. Next listener says, years ago, their uncle claimed that he grew a rhododendron in a home landscape in Midvale, and they want to know, what do they have to do to grow them in Utah, or is it even possible to do so?
Well, I mean, every once in a while, for whatever reason, you have one that will take, even in alkaline soil, and it looks okay. Never like it would in North Carolina or Oregon, but it does okay. I've known a few people that live on the bench areas that have pockets of either granite or quartz-based soil that is more neutral or maybe even slightly acidic. And so there's areas in Farmington, areas in Fruit Heights and Kaysville on the bench, areas in North Ogden that people on a limited basis successfully grow things like rhododendrons, azaleas, and dogwood trees. But it's less than 1% of the soil on the Wasatch Front. It's usually at the mouth of a canyon that has eroded granite or eroded quartz that sloughed off onto the bench. And so there's a fact sheet USU has about blueberries. Blueberries are closely related to rhododendrons. And so the care of blueberries as far as the soil conditions and fertilizing is very similar. But 98 times out of 100, people buy the rhododendron. They spend a lot of money on special fertilizers and composts, and then they dig it out 2 or 3 years later.
The other issue with those isn't a soil issue, it's a climate issue. All of these plants that have been mentioned here right now are really grown in areas where there is much higher humidity and much higher rainfall. So even if we can get them to grow well in a particular pocket of soil, unless there's a way to mitigate the dry air, they tend to have a lot of leaf scorch.
Growing them in afternoon shade.
They look terrible. And so just because we have this arid climate that doesn't do where a lot of stuff that is adapted to humid climates just can't deal with the water loss.
If you are successfully growing rhododendrons, it's equivalent to having a puppy or the maintenance you're doing on a high maintenance pet with, you know, going out once a week and putting out a little Miracle-Gro mirror acid, going out every spring and maybe in the summer and top dressing with a little bit of peat moss or other compost. In the winter, if it's evergreen, then you're using an anti-desiccant on it. And there's just so many things. This, it is a hobby and you're losing money on it, but it just gives you bragging rights. I mean, I have seen one successful rhododendron and azalea garden in Utah. It was in North Ogden in a sandy soil that was probably a granite or quartz-based sand. They had scrub oak everywhere that was shading the rhododendrons in the summer. They had a lot of leaf litter that was giving them lots of organic matter that way. And it gave the person bragging rights. And that's the only successful rhododendron garden I've seen in the state.
All right. We need to take a break. When we come back, Ken, you will be up next. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500.
Rudolph. Rudolph. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw it, you would even
good morning.
Say
thank you for joining us for the KSL all Greenhouse. This is kind of weird playing this Christmas music. There's no snow outside us here at Broadcast House. There's snow at my house, and I'm in the spirit. But thank you for joining us this morning. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us your questions at 57500. Ken is on the line in Orem, and good morning. Ken, what was your question?
Yeah, good morning. I appreciate the KSL Greenhouse. I've been listening since Dwayne Hatch, and I'm a early 90s master gardener with Larry Sagers.
Awesome.
But I have a hobby greenhouse that's 10 by 16. And along the back wall, I would like to put a row of 55-gallon drums to hold the heat and moderate the temperature in there, full of water. And I was just wondering, should those together or separated a little bit for air circulation, and I was going to insulate behind it with hay bales. Should there be a
I'll turn this one over to you
or anything between those?
Yeah, so okay, putting water in greenhouses is a pretty old practice. It's usually combined with insulating the north wall, also insulating the north slope of the roof, if that's possible, to try and slow down heat loss through the covering that really isn't primarily letting in light. But the research actually shows that those big water barrels don't give the heat back fast enough to really help nearly as much as if you used a lot of small bottles. So particularly like the 2-liter bottles, empty clear 2-liter bottles work really, really well because they absorb the energy pretty quickly because there's a lot of surface area for the amount of water they contain. And then they're able to radiate that back out at night pretty thoroughly, where the bigger water barrels tend to radiate a lot of the heat out of that water from the outer few inches close to the wall of the barrel, but not so much from the center of the barrel. So you're actually not able to access all that thermal mass with those really large barrels.
Okay, so the heat exchange isn't fast enough to heat up at night.
Exactly, yeah. It's a surface area thing. It's a surface area thing.
And
go ahead.
I think also that the water works better for bigger greenhouses. If you have more like a cold frame or something, it's less effective. Because you have less water in there, I think is assuming.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it a good idea to spray paint them those water bottles black to help absorb the heat, or is the clear work?
No, the clear actually works just fine.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah,
Ken.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call, and thanks for listening for so many years. Next listener says they have a plant that looks like a mini palm tree with a big bulb at the base. The leaves look like a spider plant, and they have little like no-see-em bugs flying in the soil and around the plant, and they're wondering what they can do.
Is that ponytail palm?
Probably ponytail palm. So the little flies or the little gnats that are flying around are probably fungus gnats. There's two primary kind of nuisance pests that come out of there, shore flies and fungus gnats. Fungus gnats fly a little slower and are probably the main nuisance. They're really hard to control. They're very, very resistant and tolerant to most pesticides. And the real problem is the larvae in the soil that feed on the roots and the organic matter as well in the soil. And that's where I target most of my approach, is trying to get the larvae managed in the soil. So indoors, a good way to manage them is actually just letting the soil dry out really, really thoroughly every time, and only watering when the soil is dry and pulling away from the edges of the pot on the inside. So the soil will start to shrink when it dries out that far, and that's a good indication of when you need to water. So they don't like that dry soil, so that tends to disrupt their life cycle if you really let it get good and dry. And that's really the only long-term sustainable approach that I'm aware of. The chemicals just aren't a good long-term approach. You can also buy beneficial nematodes that can help, and you can also buy certain strains of Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacteria that they can ingest for those types of larvae.
The particular product I'm familiar with is called Natrol, G-N-A-T-R-O-L. You can pick it up on Amazon.
Yep, and that can help to control the larvae. The adults, you can spray for them. You probably won't kill them. I've tried a lot of things over the years, and it doesn't really control the adults very well. But you can hang up yellow sticky cards, and the adults will get attracted to those to some extent, and you can start to whittle down the adult population that way.
Okay. Next listener says, can you put too many leaves and mulch in your garden area? Can you put too much?
You can always get too much of something, you know, and so the recommendation from USU is usually maximum around 3 or 4 inches that then would be worked into the soil. If you want to leave that much there over the winter, it'll partially break down, and then you can work it into the soil in the spring. I've read a lot of old World War I, World War II era gardening manuals before chemical fertilizers were super common, and they would do a lot of compost and mulch through the season, but it was dosed out through the entire year. And so your major application of, say, a partially composted steer manure, if you were doing 2 or 3 inches, would be in the fall after you're done gardening, and it would be spaded into the soil or worked in, and you let it sit all winter for the salts to work through and for the manure to break down. And then for extra nitrogen, they would use manures from chickens, turkeys, horses, cows, whatever. But they would only apply about a half of an inch at a time every 3 or 4 weeks, maybe an inch at the most. And so you were putting down 5 or 6 inches of organic matter in different forms annually, but it was dosed out through the season so soil microorganisms could keep up to break it down so that you didn't stunt your plants from a lack of nitrogen.
So a really thick organic matter layer too can become kind of soggy and collapse on itself, and then it can actually cause a little bit of, you know, water infiltration problems. So yeah, too much of a good thing. If you're mixing into the soil and kind of spreading it out and trying to keep it open a little bit to where it doesn't cause this kind of impermeable slimy barrier, then a thicker layer can work just fine.
And just along those lines, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a big thing. You know, leave the leaves alone to help protect your wildlife, you know, beneficial insects. But if you have leaves all over your grass and they're piled 3 or 4 inches thick as the snow lands and compresses those leaves, you get an impermeable barrier that's low oxygen where diseases like snow mold thrive. And a lot of times if you leave that leaf litter on the lawn itself, it's fine in your garden and things to a certain extent. If you leave it on the lawn, it'll kill it.
Okay. That can just smother the crowns.
We need to take a break for the top of the hour news. When we come back, we're going to talk about winterizing your small engines. Maria Chalaios, Ton Bettis, Michael Caron with you this morning. We'll be taking your calls and questions as well. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500.